Welcome to episode number 13 of Become a Guitarist Today with myself, Adam Roach. In this episode, I sit down with Marcel Yamuni at his studio, Captain Vive Productions. We get to talk about his musical family, his new duo with his brother Joe, who also works at Guitar Works, which is located at GM Studios in Camberfield, Melbourne. Now, Marcel is a very talented musician. Not only is he a master on the guitar, he also is a master on the bass guitar as well. Marcel talks about how he started playing guitar and bass guitar. Also in this interview, Marcel demonstrates how to get some really good sounds just by using one guitar and one pedal. Just by using the volume controls and the tones on the guitar, you get some really good sounds. Now we also get an exclusive story about his journalist career interviewing Larry Carlson and Robin Ford, which is a great story. You don't want to miss that one, so stay tuned. And for the first time on one of my podcasts, we get to listen to some of the tracks off Marcel's album, which can be found on his website and also through iTunes. So check out the link. So let's go over the interview with Marcel.
So here we are with Marcel Yamuni.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, how are you, mate?
Yeah, I'm very well, thanks.
Thanks for joining us. It's been a long time.
It has.
Actually, probably the first time I actually sat down in person and spoke.
Yeah, I know. Like, I was at your wedding.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But I was in the band.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was a fun day.
That was great.
Really good. Yeah, with Jimmy Couples and...
Yeah, and Jason. And what was the drummer?
Jason and Davey Porter.
Yeah,
Jason,
that's right.
Boyer, Davey Porter.
Yeah.
Shout out to those guys.
Yeah.
That wasn't the last time we saw each other, though. We've seen each other a few times.
Yeah, other gigs and everything.
Yeah.
So let's start with what age you started playing guitar.
All right. Okay. Well, I was pretty young, actually. I was probably around about six when I probably started. Now, I've sort of been self-taught mainly my entire life, other than my brother Joe. He was learning.
Yep.
He was actually getting formal lessons.
Okay.
And he used to use me as his backing track, if you will.
Okay.
So he'd show me some stuff and then...
Yeah.
And he'd make me play rhythm guitar for hours on end while he practiced his soloing, which at the time I really hated because I was kind of like, I really want to, get into it as well. But I didn't realize he was setting me up. Yeah. He probably didn't realize he was setting me up for a future of solid rhythm. I think my sister had an acoustic guitar, and again, she was learning at school. All my siblings are quite a bit old. Well, not quite a bit older than I am, but my sister's about 5 years older than I am. My brother Dave's 11 years older.
Mm.
My brother Joe's 13 years older. So, it's quite a big gap. So they already kind of, they were already going by the time I was even sort of interested.
Yep.
So I come from more or less a musical family.
Yeah.
We all play something.
Yep.
Is
the middle one played? Was it Dave, is it?
Yeah, Dave. Dave was he was more the tech guy. So I kind of got like... a mishmash of all my siblings in one person. So Dave was like, he was a keys player. So he played.
Okay.
So he had a lot of now what we would consider vintage synths, but back then they were the cutting edge. There's one actually behind you there, SH-101, which is actually a sought after kind of bit of gear. But David gave me that when I was about 7 years old because he kind of went, oh, I don't use it anymore. It was the early 80s. He goes, oh, I only used it for sequencing. I never used it for sounds. Okay. I think sounds incredible.
Yeah,
and it's one of the more sought after kind of keyboards. But but he sold all his other stuff and, I mean, he upgraded over the years. So this room that we're in now has always been a studio.
Oh, really?
To a certain degree, it's always had gear in it, at least anyway.
Yeah.
Keyboards and recording equipment started on a 4-track and the whole bit. That's all right. You're a popular man.
Record drums in there too?
Yeah. Well, downstairs there's a the size of this. These two rooms here is downstairs as well.
Oh, so the studio.
Yeah. Well, that's where we track the live instruments, like vocals and drums and even guitar amps and what have you when it's required. So anything that's loud can go down there. We've got a loom that goes through the roof and down there. And So this room's always been more or less the control room, if you will. And it's always had some recording gear. So it started with my brother Dave when he lived. This has been our family home for my entire life. So that's over 40 years now.
Yep.
So Yeah, so Dave was that guy. Joe was my brother Joe, the eldest brother. Mm. He was a singer, guitar uh-huh. player, yes. songwriter, and, you know, all that sort of stuff. Still is.
Mm.
But he runs a business now called Guitar Works, which is like a guitar repairs
yep.
out of GM Sound yeah, in yep. Campbellfield.
Yep.
So he's a multifaceted guy anyway. He's mm-hmm. He knows how to do quite a few things, but yeah. that's his project at the moment.
Okay.
And funnily enough, I'm getting him back into singing after 20-odd years of not yeah. doing it, and he's sounding really good. Ah. So we're going to do our little acoustic kind of duo thing okay. and play some fun songs yeah. and get out there. So
has he got like a particular style, like bluesy? Or
yeah, he's kind of like he's definitely bluesy. Mm. He's got a nice gravel in his voice.
Yeah.
But... It's funny, in the last 3 years, he stopped smoking, so...
Uh-huh. Lost the gravel?
He hasn't completely lost the gravel, but mm. something else has happened where his range has actually improved.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like like we used to... Well, going back to sort of your question, when did you start and all that sort of stuff, that's when I started, but like when I started playing in bands, I actually more or less joined my brother's band when I was about 15. I was in other bands before that, but I joined his band when I was about 15, 16 as the bass player.
Yeah.
And that was sort of like the first time I kind of went up on stage and did all that sort of stuff. And it was out of necessity, really. But back then we used to tune all our guitars half a step down.
Yeah.
You know, it had a sound, but it was also mainly for the vocals to be a little bit more comfortable. Now we're like 20-odd years later, 3 years of not smoking. I'm putting capos on the on everything to make all the songs higher.
Oh wow!
You know what I mean? So he more or less stopped 20 years ago, and I kept going. So I've had this entire adventure that he wasn't a part of musically, so to speak, but in other ways, of course, he was. But It's my happy place, if you will. Like I really like jamming with my brother. There's something.
Oh, for sure.
There's something. You know. There's a connection that we have.
Yep.
I've had with people who aren't necessarily family members. Yep. You know. I've had that musically with various people over the years, but
exactly.
It's a rare thing.
Yeah. I mean, my brother's a drummer.
Yeah. Right.
Like, we grew up together playing, and just that, that little eye contact. To do.
Absolutely. When we started sort of getting back into it again, it used to be that Joe would kind of more or less, tell me how to do it. Yeah. And the shoe's on the other foot now, where I'm not as patient as he was with me, but, that's not how it goes. No, that's not the right note. No, that's not the right chord. No, it's like this. And, I got to remember, he's been out of it for 20-odd years, so... I need to be a little bit more patient, if you will. But he's doing really, really well. So we've been rehearsing down at where his workshop is.
Yep, at GM.
GM's rehearsal studio there as well. Mm. So when he's finished doing his guitar setups and repairs and all that stuff, then we'll get a room in there and fire the PA up. And
that's great.
I've got my little acoustic board here, which has got a looper and stuff, so I do like the drums and stuff on the guitar and loop it and
just the two
bass
of you?
Generator. Right now I'm just making him concentrate on singing, not so much playing guitar, but he's actually a ripper guitar player himself. I mean, he taught me. When I say I never had formal lessons, it wasn't a formal thing. It'd be literally sitting in the lounge room while he was doing his thing, and then I'd pick some things up along the way and... Yep. Almost by osmosis, you know what I mean? Learn how to play guitar.
Well, I've seen a lot of people being like that. Have interviews as well, and then just picked it up and from siblings or just from listening to the music, I guess.
Well, it's funny. I think it means more when you discover it for yourself rather than.
Yeah.
But having said that, like now I'm kind of more or less I'm craving more knowledge, so I feel like now is the time to go and see a Brett Garsett or. Yeah. I mean, even that would be way too advanced for me. Like, I really, I probably need to just go and see. Well, actually, funnily enough, even though he's extremely advanced, someone like Jack Pantazis has always been someone I've, toyed with the idea of just calling. I haven't been brave enough to call him, even though he's the most friendliest guy in the world. I haven't been brave enough to kind of call him up and go, "Hey, Jack, I really need some help expanding on things like harmony and you get a bit bored with your own playing, especially if you're a blues background and you're stuck in the box.
Yeah, that's right. Well, actually, I listened off Jack.
Yeah, right.
After VC,
he's the best.
I did the advanced certificate in music in Greensboro, and he was one of the teachers there.
Yes, that's right. Well, that's where I first met him.
Oh, was it?
So it was 95 I got to NMIT.
Oh, okay. I was in 90, so.
It was weird. I kind of did year 11 and 12 as a bass player. So in my tertiary studies, I kept it going. I kept the bass going. So depending on when you met me in my life, it determines whether you know me as a bass player or as a guitarist.
Yeah.
You know, so back then, I was playing a lot of bass. So now I kind of regret it because I remember seeing a lot of the students who, when they started the course, they were good.
Yep.
But when they finished 2 years later, they were extraordinary.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, that's got to have something to do with Jack.
You know,
as a teacher, because he was, I just see him come out and they'd be, you know, they'd be jazzing it up and envious.
I mean, but I still am.
Yeah.
But you still do bass so well, though, like bass and
guitar. Yeah, I still play bass and guitar. I mean, this studio here, we kind of, I wanted to call it One Stop Shop Productions because I more or less have to do everything because not everyone has the budget to kind of go outside of and, you know, hire a bunch of musos. So I kind of end up doing the guitars, the basses, the keyboards even to a certain extent, depending on how hard the songs are, and I do have limited key skills, but you can see I've got a little drum thing to, I can either program them in or go downstairs and play them and edit them up and all that stuff. I try not to do that. That's probably the one instrument where I really try and convince clients to hire, you know, someone to come in. So I'll get someone like Johnny Salerno, who played on my record. It's funny, like when I first got serious about recording people in here, I went and got a business loan and, you know, bought like a HD rig, which is sitting over there, which is obsolete now, but back then it was state of the art. And I was learning how to do sounds, like, you know, record and all that stuff. And Johnny was my, he was my friend, and, you know, but he was also my guinea pig at the time and still is. Even though he's an absolute monster, always was. He was always a monster, real consistent hitting guy, like just made it actually a lot easier to record him because he was like, he just made me sound better straight away. Like just by having the right guy hitting the right way, he's always had a knack for that, like real super consistent. There are other great drummers, Marcus Ryan, you know, there's heaps. I work with a lot of really great, I'm very lucky.
Yeah, for sure.
I get to work with a lot of really good players. But yeah, Johnny's been sort of the main guy that I've had here in the studio over the years.
Yeah.
And so I remember when I first started, I was just putting too much processing on and trying, you know, like, and then it got simpler and simpler as time went, and I discovered that where to position the mics, and I learnt my room downstairs, what, you know, where, what mic sounds good, where, and all that sort of stuff.
Okay.
And my brother Joe helped me a lot with that too, because he's always sort of been the assistant, if you will. He's not necessarily, he doesn't know how to use all this stuff here, computers and all that stuff. He knows, he's been in enough studios over the years to know how to mic stuff up. That's what I mean by he's multifaceted in the sense, you know, he's a guitar repairer, he's a, you know, stage manager, he's a singer, he's a guitar player, you know, public speaker, maybe not. But so it's all, all family sort of base. Yeah. And yeah, with Johnny, we ended up doing a record together, which I believe you've...
That's this one.
Well, it lapsed on iTunes. I had it going through the TuneCore, whatever it was that I had it running through, and I just forgot to renew it. And then 2 years went by, and I thought, you know what? I should probably re-release it, you know, out there again, because there's a whole new bunch of next generation of guitar players and stuff that I've met in the last few years that probably haven't heard it and wouldn't know about it. So I thought, I'll re-release it. I thought, okay, I'll do a... I had already a tune that I'd done post my record, which I got a friend of mine from Sydney, Michael Dolce. I don't know if you know Michael. Plays on the Voice and has worked with Delta Goodrum, and he's worked with everyone. He's an incredible guitar player.
Yeah.
Real amazing legato, kind of like Brett Garsett, you know what I mean? Like, a disciple. We're all disciples of Brett, but some, like Michael can actually do that.
Yeah.
You know, like he can actually play that quick and do all the beautiful runs and lines. So, yeah. But the thing is, I met him when I was playing with Vanessa Amorosi, and we were doing some awards show in Sydney, and he needed an acoustic guitar, so he came up and asked me. I didn't have one, but our keyboard player, funnily enough, had one.
Was it Paul?
And Paul, Paul Ciacanelli. Yeah. He played acoustic in the band as well as keys and percussion. Yeah. Another very talented man.
Yeah, he is.
I was in my first band with Paul.
Okay.
Yeah, so you were jumping around again. Michael needed an acoustic, so Paul lent him his. And then we would have thought he'd become friends with Paul, not me, but we ended up, this was in the MySpace days, hitting each other up on MySpace. And on MySpace, you could actually, if you had a band page or a music page, you could have like four or five songs. Yep. So Michael had four or five songs, and there was this one particular tune where he was chicken picking, and it's on his record. It's it's unbelievable. Like I was like, that was it for me. I was like, this dude's a heavyweight.
Yeah.
You know, like really incredible playing. And we've been, he's my Sydney compadre, if you will, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So whenever I'm there, he always offers to pick me up from the airport and vice versa when he comes here. So we've been friends for quite a few years now. So he's actually, he does a guest solo. So we end up doing like this is what I mean. The point being that I ended up putting a bonus track on the record. It's called Massive Rat. So it's last tune on the record. So Michael he does the first, so there's a bit of a solo section sort of towards the end, and it actually finishes with us both soloing. Yeah, we do a dueling guitar thing, so that was fun, because obviously he lives in Sydney and I live here, so I gave him the first solo. I said, you do the first solo. So I said, at this point here, you know, of the song, come in. Anyway, he sends me the first solo, and I nearly fell off my chair when I first heard it. I just went, oh my God, how am I even going to... I know music's not a competition, and it's not, but I was like, how am I going to actually keep up with this guy? You know, like, or at least play something that was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
So after I reckon it took me a couple of weeks to actually build up my chops to the point where I didn't sound completely embarrassing. I finally kind of committed to one, because he wanted to go solo for solo. So he said, rather than me just do the solos in the blank spots, and then you do the solos in the blank spots, I'll do one, send it to you. You do one, send it back. I'll do one, send it to you.
Okay.
That was his idea.
Yep.
So I went, that's a great idea, because it's kind of like, all right, well, how do we do this? Let's go. So it was actually a lot of fun. It was over a period of a few days. And once I actually sacked up and went, okay, I'm going to commit to doing this. It took a few days of just sending it backwards and forwards, the wonders of the internet. And then you'll hear it if you've got Apple Music or Google Play or something. You can have a listen to that track.
Yeah.
And Massive Rat.
When you were talking about the recording with in Sydney.
Yep.
So I'll take this chance to thank you for recording on our album.
Oh, no worries at all.
That turned out really good too.
Yeah, it was good fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that was all done here as well.
Yeah, that's right. Start with the first track, the Monkey Fingers.
Okay.
So you're playing bass and guitar and everything, aren't you, in the album?
Yeah, and keyboards.
Oh, and keys, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because that's something, I mean, to hear that for me, you know, you can hear like an amazing bass player, an amazing guitarist.
Right.
So, you know what I mean? So it's like, to have both of those things going for you, it's great.
Yeah, I was a bored kid, so I sort of, I'd play a bit of guitar, and then I was fascinated with bass as well. I was that annoying guy at rehearsals that would always, you know, when everyone took a break, I'd hop on the bass player's bass and play it for a bit, and then hop on the drums and play it for a bit. And But play a bit of the keys and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, I was that annoying kid that did all that.
Because the thing I find is, you know, you get a lot of guitarists that jump on bass. You can tell they're a guitarist playing bass. You know
right,
I mean?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
If you, you actually sound like a bass player, it's...
It's funny, I mean, I started on guitar, so the guitar came, I won't say it came naturally, I reckon I worked pretty hard at it, like to, to build, I wasn't naturally a quick guitar player, I still can't do arpeggios and things like that.
Yeah.
I always had a keenness for rhythm, and funnily enough, I probably started on drums first, but then broke the drum kit when I was a kid, but then I didn't realise you can actually reskin them, so we just threw it in the rubbish, but yeah, I was always, you know, I had the taps, if you will. I was always tapping things and annoying my teachers at school and stuff like that. But bass came more or less out of necessity, like I was saying before. I was playing in my brother's band because they needed a bass player, and I would have done anything to be in that band. So it was one of those things where I just went, yeah, I'll play bass, you know. So I think initially we were hiring basses and bass amps to get me to do it. So I was probably playing bass like a guitarist back then, but I was definitely into it. And I think someone showed me someone actually gave me a video of Jaco Pastorius. Oh, what was his name? John Patitucci.
Oh, yeah.
So I had those two instructional videos. The Pastorius one kind of went over my head straight away. Like that was, but to see what a bass could do, like how far it could go, because you know, it's a relatively new instrument. The electric bass, that is.
Yeah,
you know, it's 60 years old or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And what he did with it, and being a guitar player as well, it kind of appealed to me, the concept, or the oxymoron, if you will, of lead bass.
Yeah.
You know, I really loved that. Not saying that he didn't play bass like a bass player. He was an incredible bass player. But he could actually solo on it and really step up and be entertaining at the same time. So that was the Pastorius element. But the John Patitucci was I don't know if anyone's ever seen that video. You can probably see it on YouTube or something like that. But he talked about technique. He talked about how to curl your fingers and how to get a clearer sound, which, you know, the whole bit. He was also, and he went through styles as well, like some very, like how to play rock, how to play a funk thing, how to do this and that. So I studied that. When I say studied that video, I sat in front of it after school and watched it quite a lot and mimicked what he was doing. So, again, even though I say I never had formal training, it was sort of the era of the VHS instructional video, you know, all that sort of stuff. So I used to love watching those things and kind of learning from the greats, if you will.
Mm. So it sounds like with your playing both guitar and bass, it's probably more, I guess, like researching the instrument, rather than like this note, that note, you know what I mean?
Play by feel, that kind of thing, you know, really. And on the job, like when I joined my brother's band, make no mistake about it, I was overplaying.
Yeah.
I was playing bass like a guitarist.
Okay.
But I was very lucky. I had a gentleman by the name of Trevor Young, who's sadly no longer with us, but he used to play with Lobby Lloyd and the Coloured Balls and play with a lot of bands in the 70s and stuff. He was quite a well-known dude back then, you know, especially amongst the rock fraternity of Australia. And you know, anyone that knows Lobby Lloyd knows that is the godfather of the Aussie rock sound, if you will. And there was a lot of improvisation, a lot of rock improvisation. Like, they'd jam for hours, like that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I got to work with Trevor for a few years in my brother's band, and I learnt how to be a bass player from him.
Yep.
More or less to this day, it's one of the main reasons why I turn my back to the audience a lot of times and head to the drummer. It's my sort of safe zone, you know. basically, I remember the first gig I did with Trevor, no rehearsals, none of that. It's pretty much it's straight out and let's go. You know, they taught me the songs probably in this room, my brother and the guitar player of the band, and then out doing it, and then playing bass like a guitarist, and then Trevor just reining me in straight away. Going, oi, come here. Guys, you don't take your eyes off me for the rest of the gig.
Oh, really?
It was that kind of thing. Yeah. And then lock in. Let's go.
Yeah.
And so 3 years of doing that taught me a lot. And he was a very free-spirited player, so we never played the same thing twice, which ultimately frustrated the band in the end, but it was a great way to learn. I would encourage any young musician to grab a bunch of your mates, get into a garage and play for hours and hours and hours and make that noise, you know, improvise, you know, I mean, it's fun for one thing. Yep. I mean, I still think that's fun. I don't think that'll ever stop being fun to me.
Yeah, for sure.
It's the best way to learn as well. It's the best way to learn how to create. And even with songs, like when you're in an original band, like learn the nuances, you know. And I think that's what I did with the bass as well. Like, so I didn't sort of, as most guitar players would, I didn't grab a pick and go on a bass straight away. I learned to use my fingers and I explored the various parts of where the right hand should sit close to the bridge, gets you a nice tight kind of treblier sound as opposed to up closer near the neck where you get a little bit more warmth and punch and in between, you know, working through all that. I mean, it's the same with a guitar, you know, like it's no different. I mean, I take that same approach with even drums, keys, the whole music in general, like how to kind of get the most out of it. I think I spent probably a couple of years ago, I was doing a regular Sunday gig at the ESPY with Dale Ryder.
Okay.
And I would take an amp with one overdrive pedal and I would do our two sets of music with just one guitar, one pedal, more or less one sound, but I'd try and get all the different tones out of the guitar. Yep. Yeah. And it was good. It was a good way to do it because as you can see, when you look around here, there's pedals and there's talent boxes, as I call them. They're everywhere. Yeah. You know, it's quite easy to get stuck in that world and, you know, hit one note and it does 50 things, you know? Like the Edge, you know, which is great. And that's an art in itself.
Mm.
And one that that I love.
Yeah.
But, yeah, just sort of being able to explore the instrument as far as you can take one particular sound.
Yep.
Yeah, hence why I actually set all my guitars up with treble bleeds. Like this guitar that I'm holding right now is a Les Paul. Belongs to my brother, but what's his is mine and what's mine is his. So, the volume is on one right now.
Yep.
But as I increase the volume, so you'll always see me reaching for the, you know, the volume and the tones and all that stuff. So I make sure that part of my guitar is always set up like that so I can be as expressive as possible. Yeah. You know, same with the neck pickup, same thing. Yeah. Quite clean.
Yeah.
So that's all the way up. A little bit backed off. In here it gets a bit stringier. And then in the middle setting, where they're both up, sometimes I'll just turn the neck pickup down in the middle setting. Kind of get the... like almost an in-between sound, you know, if you will.
That's good.
So I'll do that with strats. I'll do that with, you know, tellies, the whole bit. I try and have them all set up where I can... The idea with the treble bleed is a lot of the times with a stock guitar, when you turn the volume down, it goes a bit... It goes darker.
Yeah,
the tone goes, and then it's not the same tone that, whereas with these, it's, you can hear it's kind of pretty smooth. You can hear all the... So, yeah, you've got a nice big palette of tones just there in the one volume that you can start experimenting with.
And, yeah, that's really...
You know, doing all that kind of stuff.
Like I said, it really does open up the guitar as an instrument.
Yeah, yeah.
Rather than relying on pedals.
Yeah, I think mainly, like, the three... It's, I know I've got a lot of guitars here, and they're all, they're all subtly different, but the big three, I would say, would be a Strat, a Les Paul, and a Telecaster.
Yep.
That would be the Desert Island guitars, where I could more or less do any gig with any one of those three. Where it gets trickier is that, you know, you might put a humbucker in the bridge of a Strat, and then all of a sudden it's a different animal again. You know? But generally speaking, I try and keep it simple in that regards. You know, there's not a lot of trickery. You know, just a good amp.
Yeah. So the next one you got is... You do, don't you, with Brett Garson on slow guitar?
Yep. Well, that's the only way to, you know, slow that guy down.
give him
a slide and say, you can only use a slide, Brett.
Yeah.
It's still my favourite part of the entire record, you know what I mean?
But, yeah.
It's like, you know, he's my, and mine and many others, absolute hero. I've just, when I first saw him play, it definitely changed the game.
And a really nice guy too.
And he's the best guy ever. He's so calm and thoughtful, and he's really amazing with his time. He's got the patience of a saint.
Yeah.
Recently at the guitar festival, the Melbourne Guitar Festival, I did a bit of a spot there.
Yeah.
And saw him just walk in, and I was like, hey, Brett, how you going? Like that. And he's like, hey, mate, how you going? I go, are you playing here? Like, where? Because I didn't know. Like, I was like, because I want to go and sit. No, I'm just coming to have a look.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, there's an injustice in the world. It's like, this guy's just coming to have a look, and I'm doing a spot? I don't think so. There's definitely something wrong with the world. But, yeah, he was getting hassled by everyone.
Yeah, I imagine.
I had to hassle him as well. It was one of those things. It was funny. I saw him and Michael. They were both at the Charles Cilia stand, and I just went, my brother was there. Joe was there. I go, Joe, I'm going to arrange this right now. I got to get a photo with these two. This needs to happen. I did it.
I
went and gushed Michael R. So,
For sure.
Yeah.
It's funny, we went and saw Robin Ford.
Oh, yeah.
End of the gig, he's like, no photos.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like, everyone's lined up, get autographs. Like, sorry, no photos. Like, that was a bit of a shame.
I got a bit of a funny story about a mate of mine. Do you know Juno Roxas?
Yeah.
I reckon this story needs to finally come out on a podcast.
All right.
Okay.
So exclusive.
This is an exclusive. This is something that Juno and I have had. Juno's a very outspoken dude.
Yeah.
A lot of people get offended by what he has to say. And the thing is that if you know him, you can kind of go, he really is trying to actually get a rise out of people. Like, he's actually a lovely, lovely dude. But he just writes some really outlandish kind of stuff on Facebook. Anyway, that's not the story. The story is, because you mentioned Robin Ford, I used to write for Australian Musician, hence my connection with Greg and Rob Walker, hence why I probably got asked to do the guitar show. Anyway, again, digressing. Get to the story, man. Right. I used to get asked to write for that magazine. Every now and then we do interviews with some really, really cool people. So the first interview I ever did in my life was with Toto.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I like my heroes.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
So I'm interviewing Steve Lukather, Simon Phillips, Bobby Kimball, Greg Fillinganes.
Wow.
Incredible, right? Like, yeah. In fact, when I was driving to that interview, if there was a way you could do a U-turn on the Eastern Freeway, I would have done it and gone back home and just chickened out. But I actually did it, and it was great. It was an amazing time. The second interview that I've ever done in my life was with Larry Carlton and Robin Ford. Yeah. Now, it was my last interview I ever did with anyone. And the reason being, Gino and I are hanging out a lot. Good mates, very, you know, loves to talk about music. You know, he's a huge Steely Dan fan and huge music fan. He's not just a rock singer from the 80s. He was a, he can sing jazz. He can do it all, right? He's a really very talented man. I knew he was a huge Larry Carlton fan. And I went, okay, well, I like Robin Ford. You like Larry Carlton. You know what I mean? I love Larry Carlton too. But like, I called him up. Once they asked me to interview, I called him up and said, listen, tomorrow, what are you doing? Nothing? Cool. You're coming with me. We're going to go and meet Larry Carlton and Robin Ford at the Grand Hyatt. We're going to interview them. Get some questions ready, some things that you want to ask, yada, 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 yada. Great. Awesome. We even got like free tickets to the show. It was great. Awesome. No worries. We get to the Hyatt. We're both kind of a bit nervous because we're not really journalists. We're fans, you know, first, right? So we get to finally meet them and shake their hands, and then we're sitting down at the Grand Hyatt, and this is how the interview starts. I go, Juno, do you want to maybe take the first question? He asks. He goes, Larry, like that. Real confident, like, too. He goes, tell us about your time in the Yellow Jackets. Larry Carlton goes, I wasn't in the Yellow Jackets. Are you sure? Like that.
Really?
He asked him if he was sure. I think he would know if he was in the Yellow Jackets or not. So we got off to a bad start straight away, and it got worse. Interview got progressively worse from that moment. And I went, why did I bring Juno with me? You know what I mean? But I'll tell you something, we still, to this day, laugh about the, you know, tell us about your time with the Yellow Jackets, you know. It went horribly. That entire interview went horribly. There's more to it, but I can't actually talk about it. But you can get the gist of where that interview went and all that sort of stuff. And in the end, like, they weren't particularly nice to us.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
After those questions?
Definitely those questions didn't help. But, it was one of those things where I was kind of like, geez, you know, if you had... Like, we explained that we were fans and all that sort of stuff, and, you know, I was kind of like, oh, all right, fair enough. But having said that, anybody else that's ever met Larry Carlton has always said he is the nicest guy. I even got that just, like, before we did the interview. I thought, oh, no, this will be good because these are great guys, you know, and all that sort of stuff. And, not to us. They didn't like us. Which is fair enough. I actually don't blame him in hindsight, but it was a funny story. Juno and I still... talk about that one to this day. I think we'll take that one to our graves.
So I go to the next song, which is Heart Trouble.
Right, yep.
Now, so what was the main inspiration behind this one? Because when I listen to it, like the melody, a beautiful melody and everything, like for me, it's like you really hear a story being told through your guitar playing.
Yep.
So how'd that one come about?
Funny because all the songs do have kind of a little, even though I don't sing, I do try and express it through the instrument.
Yeah, I definitely know.
If it was a singer, you will.
For sure.
Heart Trouble is an interesting one. I mean, it's sort of the title almost says what it's about. But when I was about 23, I think it was, I actually had an irregularity in my heart. I had what they call Wolf Parkinson White. So I had like an extra pathway in my heart. And what would happen is I could be sitting here talking to you, then all of a sudden my heart would jump to 190 BPM just like that. You know, it was an extra pathway that the blood would go down, and it was things would trigger it, random things would trigger it. One of my mates has actually got it and needs to get it zapped. Mm. So I got it zapped. But it was one of those things where it wasn't life-threatening. It was just sort of more or less a birth defect, if you will. Yeah, so my life was on hold for about a year. But, you know, that's the heart trouble bit. So it's kind of almost a tribute to that time.
Yeah.
But like any kind of, you know, sad love song, you know, heartbroken kind of thing, that's what's going on with that one.
Yeah, but
any,
like I said,
any girl that I've ever kind of broken up with, you know, that song's for you. to get all nice and corny on that one.
But no, you definitely feel it, like, just listening to it.
It's one. It's actually it's a one-taker as well, really? That one. Wasn't the first take, but it was from start to finish. You can hear I overbend and underbend on certain parts of the certain part. If you listen, you don't even have to listen that carefully to hear it. But there was a soul that was in it that in that particular performance where I was in this room. It was very dark and only the illumination of little LEDs and from all the bits of gear were kind of lighting the room up.
And I
managed to do a pretty good
That's great
performance. And then I added the reverb and delay later on.
It definitely comes across though, you do.
The funny thing with that one, and not to keep going on about Brett Garsett, but the thing is, he's the greatest, so might as well. He actually paid a really nice compliment once. He goes, "Man, how did you get that tone on that song, you know, Trouble?" He goes, I want that tone as my lead guitar tone. I said, "You know what it is? It was an all brick amp that I had. I don't have that amp anymore. I can get the tone with other amps, but that one was the one that was used, and it did a great job. I multi-mic'd it and the whole bit. But the piece de resistance, I was using a Mexican Telecaster that had really light strings on it, tuned to E flat. And what was happening, and I played with my fingers. So that whole performance is just hands, no plectrum. So I can't actually get that tone out of this because this guitar has been set up beautifully and it's a Les Paul. So every time I would hit, the strings were so loose and flappy because it was in a semitone down and it was on a Telecaster. So it was making almost like a sitar-y kind of sound. So there's no effects other than delay and reverb and the overdrive from the amp itself. So it's just hand.
Do you think that's why you overbent? Because you tune that E flat?
Could possibly be, and the light strings as well. Yeah.
I didn't notice it listening to it. But
Well, that's the thing.
Like, I'll go back and listen to that.
That's the thing. Yeah, light strings, Telecaster. The Telecaster had these Diamond pickups from a Gretsch that we chucked in it. It was one of those guitar experiments that could have gone in the Why the Hell Did We Do That file, but it actually ended up having a vibe about it. It's inside somewhere.
Yeah.
But rusty, year and a half old strings.
Yeah.
So the guitar probably was, the intonation was probably way out.
Yeah.
And it all just contributed to that moment, that sound and playing with the hands and channeling, you know, Jeff Beck, if you will. Trying. You know. I always try and channel that guy whenever I'm trying to play a ballad or...
Yeah.
It's either him or Satriani. Mm-hmm. I know they're worlds apart, but two big influences for me coming up. Even though I can't do anything like how they do it.
Yeah.
But the fact that they were instrumentalists and they wrote really melodic tunes, rock-based kind of stuff, that it really appealed to me coming up.
Yeah.
That's what I wanted to do. Yeah. Still want to do it.
Yeah.
If I can. Yeah. But hard in Australia.
Oh, for sure.
You know,
so that's what I noticed with this whole album, actually, like listening to it. I think just the guitar playing, it's not like over your head, over your face, like
burning. That's because I can't do it. If I could do it, I'd probably I'd release an album of Burning if I could.
There's still like some stuff in there that, like, I think it was Full Dirties, was it? There's Jim and Steve, and there's a little arpeggio part with really nice playing at Fast Again, but Yeah, the whole album was like that.
You think, they weren't, if you notice and have a listen back to it again, they're not full kind of arpeggios, if you will. They're just, they're sort of, I can only kind of do like half an arpeggio. I only ever that's use right. them to kind of get to the note. I don't have it, not in my vocabulary, not yet anyway. I'll work on it. I promise. Like I can't do an arpeggio from down here to up here. You know, there's a local guy who moved from America in the 90s. He moved to Australia. He married an Australian girl, a guy named John Sanders, who he goes by the name of Doug Steele. I don't know if you know him. So he used to come into the shop a lot, the shop being Main Street Music, which my family owned at the time. And so we met a lot of great players coming through. John was an incredible guitar player, and he could do all the crazy, you know. I'm going to do it very bad, but but properly.
Yep.
You know, and like incredible, like with ferocity and intensity and, you know, just beautiful playing. So I can't do that. So I'll leave that to him. He can do that. That was probably one of the earlier tunes that got recorded at another time, you know, like, and then I decided to add it to the record and get it up to the level of the other tunes.
Good. Now, what I was going to ask about is that, it's good. Now, I'm just going to guess, did you get the title from, like, you finished it and you're like, it's good? Is that it? Or...
I think, you know what it was? It's good. For starters, is it's such a...
Classic.
A colloquialism? Is that what they call it? Like, something like an Australian colloquialism. That kind of thing. It actually has a few different meanings. It's like, it can also be like a someone that's being kind of a bit sarcastic. Like, it's good. That kind of thing. So, I think I was saying it quite a lot at that time. So, a lot of these tunes don't necessarily have titles. That may have been a working title, you know, because sometimes I'll have a working title. You can ask me about some of them. I remember what the working titles are, and some of them I don't. But that one, because, you know, you got to, when you're composing something, you know, you got to save it on your computer as something. I just... that's good. And that was it. And that one just stuck.
That was classic. I love it.
That's why, and you'll see the theme is you do, don't you? That was another one. Like the second track on the record is the same kind of thing that we were saying a lot back then.
You do, don't you?
even Full Dirties, I think one of my mates came up with that one. And for all the feminists out there, block your ears. But I think he used it to describe a particular girl. You know, she's a full dirty, like, as a compliment, though. Like, she's a full dirty, you know, like, she's full dirties, man. Full dirties.
Yeah.
That's it.
Now, the other one I want to ask about is that song, is it Linus?
Song for Linus, Linus. Yeah, right.
Because the solo on that's really good.
Linus was my Balinese cat.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he was a long-haired Siamese. He was the cutest thing ever, and he was very much a family member. On the actual album, I actually credit a dedication to him. Now, anyone that has ever owned a pet will know exactly what I'm talking about. They definitely become family members. And his untimely demise due to illness was like we probably spent about $5,000 trying to fix him, you know, and then it got to a point where it was actually cruel to keep trying. So yeah, but he was a very special member. Like, he brought laughter back into the house and all that sort of stuff. He was a he was a cool cat. You know, we actually haven't had a cat since.
Oh really?
Yeah. No, I we probably would. Been considering recently getting another one, but yeah, Linus was the cat, so I more or less was channeling that terrible experience of having to put him down. So if you've ever had to put your dog down or a cat down, you know exactly what I'm talking about. So yeah, just that heart-wrenching moment. Emotional, you know. I don't know. Maybe I couldn't afford therapy, and that's why I wrote these tunes.
Well, it comes across. I mean, they're really nice melodies. Both those ballads, you know.
Really feel. Oh, thank you. Well, you can probably blame Satriani for Song for Linus. I reckon his ballad playing. That was the thing about Satriani that I liked the most was there's like not just that Serving with the Alien album, but there's another album called Flying in a Blue Dream. And there's a tune on that called The Forgotten. Might even be The Forgotten Part 2.
Okay.
And it's a beautiful, you know, beautiful melody. You know, it sounds very sort of shred 90s now, but like if you actually listen to it, it's a beautifully constructed tune. So I reckon that would have had a big influence on Song for Linus. Thanks, Satch.
Yeah, that's it.
Wherever you are.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah, thanks again for doing this podcast for me.
Anytime.
Hopefully we can do a part two
in the
near future. Right. Thanks again.
No, thank you. It was good fun. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed the interview with Marcel and got some really good tips, especially on how to get the most out of the guitar by just using the volume controls and the tone controls. Now, everything on my website, Become a Guitarist Today, is half price at the moment. So what that means is the $5 package, where you get 2 months access to my Facebook group, which includes weekly lessons, and I get to answer any questions that you might have regarding guitar or anything else you might want to ask. So the $5 package is only $2.50 for 2 months. So $2.50 will get you 2 months worth of lessons. Now the $10 package, which is 4 months access to my closed Facebook group, is only $5. So $5, get 4 months access to the closed Facebook group. Then I have the $20 package, which is 6 months access to the closed Facebook group. Now that one is only $10. And then I have the big one, which is the $40 membership, which includes my book, Become a Guitarist Today. It also includes a lifetime access to my closed Facebook group. Now, at the moment, you can get that for $20. So $20, you get a book and also access to my closed Facebook group for a lifetime. Or if you do just want to get the book, you can do so. It's usually $20, but now it's only $10. So jump on over to becomeaguitaristtoday.com and go to the shop page and choose which one you would like to get, starting from $2.50 up to $20. So, until next week, keep jamming.